You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish, LLC, and Teamsters Joint Council 56. Since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would do harm. That's Boyd Kenter Thomas & Parrish. And Teamsters Joint Council 56, and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Donald Trump is eviscerating policies and legislation that favor working people. We'll talk to journalist Stephen Hill to find out how far labor has been set back by these efforts and if the working class can identify the real enemy of the people. Then, Cuba gets demonized all the time by both Republicans and Democrats. But 95% of Cuban workers voluntarily belong to unions, and women get a year of paid maternity leave. Find out more about Cuban workers on tonight's show. In the news, it looks like a big win for Los Angeles teachers, and union membership shrank again last year. Now for the news.
After 6 days on strike, with strong support from parents, students, and community members across Los Angeles, the United Teachers Los Angeles and the LA School District reached an agreement Tuesday. It was ratified that night, and teachers went back to work on Wednesday. The agreement appears to be a huge victory for the union. It addresses major issues impacting schools, students, and professions, and could have reverberations across the country as Denver, Colorado teachers vote to strike next week over similar issues. The LA victory resumes a trend begun last year by teachers in West Virginia, Arizona, Kentucky, and Oklahoma to challenge and attempt to reverse the long-term assault on public education by both Democrats and Republicans alike. The LA agreement requires the school district to call on the state to establish a charter school cap and create a governor's committee on charter schools. It also requires the union, the school district, and the mayor to advocate for increased county and state funding for nurses and special education and community schools. There will be an immediate reduction in the class size of 7 students in secondary math and English classes. All class size caps now are based on enforceable memorandum of understanding, which will continuously reduce class size. Teachers will get a 3% raise for the 2017-2018 school year, and for the current school year. There will be a nurse in every school. There will be a significant increase in the number of school librarians and counselors and improvements in special education. There's much more, including an immigrant defense fund, including a district-provided hotline and an attorney for immigrant families, and will collaborate with the UTLA for further services.
On Tuesday, the faculty at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, went on strike. Strikes by university professors are pretty rare. It must be pretty bad. The Chronicle of Higher Education reports that the dispute reached a boiling point after years of overspending without administrative oversight threw the Ohio University's finances into a nosedive. The faculty is represented by the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors. Only about 560 of its 1,700 faculty members belong to the union. They've been trying to get a new contract for 2 years, and last November, the university imposed its last and best offer, despite the union's rejection of it. With that, the board ended negotiations. The union says the strike isn't about pay raises. It's about power over their classrooms and workloads. Years of overspending, combined with declining donations and enrollment, caused Wright State's financial problems to snowball. From 2012 to 2017, the university burned through about $131 million of its reserves, depleting its total reserves from $162 million to $31 million. Also, in November, the university paid the U.S. Department of Justice a $1 million fine to settle a visa fraud investigation. Last February, the university said it had accidentally overspent by $6 million on university health benefits. In 2017, the university paid back nearly $2 million to the U.S. Department of Education because of a federal student aid problem. And in 2016, the university spent a little more than $1.7 million to prepare for a presidential debate that it didn't end up hosting. The union calls this fiscal recklessness by the trustees who value basketball and real estate more than academics. They say it's unfair for the faculty to pay the price. What the university has imposed is gutting faculty health care, giving them furlough days without pay, and increasing their workload. So they're on strike.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics has opened and issued its yearly report this week on union membership in the U.S., and despite recent victories, it continues to shrink. Union membership last year was down 0.2%, from 10.7 to 10.5 of the workforce from 2017. There were 14.7 million union members last year, little change from 2017, but the workforce size grew, thus lowering the percentage in unions. This is nothing new. Union membership has been declining almost every year since 1970. Some highlights from the report are that union membership rate in public sector workers, 34%, is more than five times higher than that of private sector workers, which is 6.4%. Most union professionals are police, fire protection, education, training, and libraries. Men continue to have higher union membership rates, 11% as opposed to 10% for women. But women are catching up. Black workers remain more likely to be union members than white, Asian, or Hispanic workers. And as always, union advantage means that union workers earn only 82% as much as workers with unions. 860 versus 1051 per week. The states with highest union membership were Hawaii and New York. The states with lowest union membership were North Carolina and South Carolina, where only 2.7 workers have unions. The biggest gain last year for workers was for education, which added more than 100,000 union members last year. Other industries that added union membership included manufacturing, entertainment, and waste services. And contrary to most predictions, the Supreme Court anti-union Janus decision didn't have much impact yet. Public sector representation dropped only 0.5% to 37.2%. Members grew among local government workers, shrank among state employees, and held steady at the federal level.
On Wednesday, American Federation of Government Employees National President David Cox was arrested outside Mitch McConnell's office, along with members and activists from the AFL-CIO and other federal unions. AFGE National President J. David Cox was arrested here's Cox after he was released from the police, saying, first off, he complimented the Capitol cops for decent treatment, and then he made this statement.
Well, I'm just getting back to the office from being arrested today, trying to get the government open. You know, it just shouldn't take having to get arrested at Mitch McConnell's office to get the government open, to get federal employees and D.C. government employees paid for the work that they're doing, or get them back on the job servicing the American people. It's time to open up this government now, and I can tell you, I am going to do everything in my power to work night and day to get the government open, keep the government open, and get federal and D.C. government employees paid.
And that was J. David Cox of AFGE. The news tonight was read by Michael Savoir, Tom Gepkin, a new volunteer from CWA. Welcome, Tom. And I'm Judy Ansel.
They pinch me in the Xerox room and they grab me in the hall. And if I say a word to them, they say it's all my fault. I walk into their office and they stare straight at my breasts. And if I take their hands away, they say it's how I'm dressed. It's the same the whole world over, happens all the time. The woman who's the victim is convicted of the crime. It's the same the whole world over, always been the same. The guilty claim they're innocent and the victim gets the blame.
Good evening and welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoir. My show tonight is titled Trump Screwdriver on Workers. The music was from Ann Feeney, and my guest tonight is Stephen Hill. Steve Hill is a U.S.-based journalist and author of 7 books, including Startup Illusion, How the Internet Economy Threatens Our Welfare, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, and 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. His articles and interviews have appeared in media around the world, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, Atlantic, Le Monde, just to name a few. Mr. Hill is former senior fellow at the New American Foundation in Washington, D.C., and was a 2018 journalist in residence at the Berlin Social Science Center. He is co-founder of Fair Vote. Good evening, Stephen. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum.
Good evening. It's a great pleasure for me to join you.
Well, certainly it's a pleasure to have you, Stephen. And, of course, our topic tonight is a big one. Where do you start, man? I'd like to remember how Mr. Trump bragged about what a friend he was to labor and how he had great relationships with labor unions. Does any of that seem to be true, Stephen?
No, I think we have to chalk that one up to Mexico will pay for the wall. We have a president that it just seems to say things and wait for people to prove him wrong. And that one, he's never had good relations with unions. He's never even had good relations with his own workers. Even before he got elected president, we saw stories of how he didn't pay some of his workers and, you know, on and on and on. So this is just more fiction around this this presidency.
Yeah, our current crisis is certainly indicative of just where he's coming from with friend of labor there. Any comments on that from your observations, Stephen?
Well, if you look at what's going on right now with the government shutdown and all the federal workers who are basically either not being paid or even being required while they're not being paid. Recently, just today, Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, said that the federal workers should take out loans if they're not getting paid. And that's sort of insensitive comment. It's just more indication about where this administration is coming from. And those are the things that catch the headlines. But in fact, the rules and the laws that protect workers are, there are big ones, that have to do with how workers are treated and how much, and wages and all these sorts of things. But there are a lot of smaller ones, too, around safety overseen by federal administrations like OSHA and other sorts of rules around arbitration agreements and whether you get paid more if you've worked a number of hours for overtime. And these are the rules, these smaller ones that don't really catch the headlines that, unfortunately, the Trump administration has been slowly chipping away at ever since he got into office. And so this is it's really been, in many ways, an all-out assault on American workers and as well as labor unions.
Yeah, well, actually, Steve, if you take a close look, you don't have to do an in-depth study. Why, it's just everywhere you look, man, the Janus ruling a while back, the digital economy ripoffs, the slashing of the NLRB regs, the imposition of collective bargaining, it just goes on and on and on. You've done a lot of work in the digital economy. Can you comment on some of those changes?
Sure. So the Trump administration mostly has taken a very hands-off approach to the digital economy and the treatment of workers in the digital economy and the gig economy. And so you see a lot of workers, Uber drivers or, Deliveroo food deliverers and all these sorts of services that really are operating beneath the radar of labor law. They're what's known as independent contractors. They're not considered regularly employed W-2 workers. And so a lot of the rules around minimum wage, for example, they've recently done studies and found that the average Uber driver is actually making, after expenses for using your own vehicle as a taxi driver, basically, that they're making less than $10 an hour. So that means they're making less than minimum wage in many cities. But on top of that, these types of workers also don't have a lot of protection for labor laws. A lot of them sometimes don't get paid for the work they do, and it's very hard. You know, if you're working for TaskRabbit, doing multiple gigs, if you're working for Upwork and you're doing work for someone who's hired you to design a website, there's a lot of examples of workers not getting paid after they've completed the work. And if they owe you $700, it's too expensive to hire an attorney to go after that $700. How are you going to collect it? So these are the problems that a lot of workers are running into as a result of working in the gig economy.
Yeah, and of course that doesn't even consider health and welfare benefits that are so critically leaving, and pensions that are leaving our workplace. Yeah,
that's right. I mean, these independent contractors, basically as a contractor, the business that hires you does not have to pay anything for your health care or even Social Security, Medicare, injured worker, unemployment compensation. A lot of these workers, they get injured on the job, and once they're injured, they're not eligible for any state unemployment benefits. And so that means they may have to take time off from work and dip into their own savings in order to pay for food and housing and things while they're injured. So it's really, as this type of the economy grows, and there's a lot of debate about how fast is the gig economy growing, but no question that it is growing, this kind of work just really starts undermining not only the workers who are working that way, but the overall labor force, because it just creates a race to the bottom. You know, if I'm an employer and you're an employer, Michael, and I'm hiring all gig workers, I'm paying about 30% less on my labor costs than you are if you're trying to do the right thing and hire regularly employed workers, right? So that puts pressure on you, because I can lower my prices by that 25-30% and undermine your competitive position in the marketplace. So that puts pressure on you and other businesses to start hiring more of these independent contractor type workers. And that, as that phenomena gains more and more momentum, and, you know, not even to mention if a lot of automation and robots starts taking away jobs, it's going to really undermine the ability of workers to have any leverage in the labor marketplace. So
oh,
this
absolutely.
Is something we really have to be concerned about and start putting regulations around so that we can prevent this from happening.
Well, you know, labor leaders, real labor leaders, have said for years that an injury to one is an injury to all. So my fight is your fight. Yours is certainly mine. And if your job can be undermined, it's just a matter of time before mine is. And a good case in point there is, of course, how
solidarity.
Yes, absolutely. We saw how manufacturing jobs.
That word doesn't get used nearly enough today. But I do see a resurgence in labor activity among teachers, and you know, we've seen a number of strikes there, and among a lot of younger people who are starting to say, "Hey, you know, I don't like this gig economy reality. What do we do about it? How do we organize?"
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, man. How much further can we bend? You know, recent financial cuts, of course, is our current crisis. But even prior to that, why the Trump administration has been cutting the budget, and so thereby adversely impacting the Department of Labor and what they're able to do just because of limited budget. Can you give our listeners some insight there?
Yeah, so besides the actual laws and regulations, there are a number of agencies, the National Labor Relations Board, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and the Department of Labor that oversee certain aspects of labor conditions. And in every instance, the Trump administration is either cutting their budgets. The Department of Labor, for example, it was cut by about 20%. So it means it has less money for enforcement and for doing studies about the conditions of workers. They also propose slashing funding for things like Job Corps, which is a program that provides job training to disadvantaged youth. That one, fortunately, they did not manage to cut, as far as I can tell. But, you know, I might have missed a headline along the way. They've undermined some of the safety and health rules in the workplace that OSHA oversees. And then some of the biggest blow came from the National Labor Relations Board. It's a 5-member board, and typically whichever administration is running the things, then you know, under Trump administration, it's got three Republicans on there and 2 Democrats. Under Obama, it had 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. So the Trump administration has done a lot to try and undermine some of the rules and regulations that the Obama era NLRB pushed forward. Some of the more egregious ones, like, for example, over fast food workers and in the fast food industry, the Obama NLRB had a rule about that, you know, like if you look at McDonald's, for example, you have this big corporation, McDonald's, but then every restaurant is part of a franchise. And so there was always this question, who does the fast food worker work for? Is it the individual franchise or is it McDonald's? And because that was never settled before the Obama administration, basically each side would say, they don't work for me. And so it was really hard for the workers to get any traction in terms of pushing for change. So the Obama administration ruled that, in fact, they work for both of them, both the individual franchise restaurant owner and for McDonald's. And that allowed labor unions to organize, and it allowed the workers to put pressure on the big corporation, McDonald's, to then put pressure on the individual franchise restaurant owners to treat the workers better. Well, the Trump administration came along, and they now have reversed that rule. So there's a number of situations and circumstances like that where the Trump administration has worked through the various federal agencies to undermine some of the good rules that the Obama administration had put in place.
Yeah, I was kind of interested in how they've kind of relaxed the rules on, or at least allowed employers to to bind employees to arbitration agreements where you lose your right to sue in case of injury or harm in the workplace. And that's one of the kind of silent issues there that just kind of doesn't get paid attention to until you've got a big injury or a lawsuit, and then you find out that, oh, you've signed an agreement that limits your their liability to some pretty small terms in terms of your financial compensation.
Right. It means that workers, you know, once you sign the arbitration agreement as a condition of employment, you can't join a class action suit with a lot of other workers just like you to sue the company. And because you can't join with them, you don't have nearly the power, and, you know, it's hard to find an attorney to handle just your one individual case because the attorney can't make enough money from that one individual case. So this was a way to basically keep workers from organizing in a legal sense by making them have to go to individual arbitration in which the odds are quite stacked against you as a worker. And, you know, and that's not just even for workers. I mean, a lot of the companies of Silicon Valley, Facebook and Google and what have you, they all make you, when you sign the end user license agreement, you know, agreeing to the conditions of using their product or service, you're oftentimes signing away your rights to join in a class and action lawsuit in case something about the product or service turns out to be harmful. And you're agreeing to just go to individual arbitration. So this is something that the conservative business forces are using wherever they can in order to prevent people from banding together to fight against some of the harmful practices that we're seeing. I mean, another one that the Obama administration did was over overtime pay. So the Obama administration made it so that you could earn more income and still be considered a worker who had to be paid overtime. And so the Trump administration, NLRB, has come along and now shrunk that down so that the impact is that fewer workers will be able to be compensated for time and a half or double time for working overtime.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners that are just joining us, I'm Michael Savoy. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum tonight. And our show is titled Trump Screwjob on Workers. Our guest is Steve Hill. And tell us, Steve, you know, I read tonight in the news a Bureau of Labor Statistics report on our shrinking labor force. It looks like at the rate things are going, man, in a few years there'll be none left. Certainly there are better models in Europe as in terms of labor's relationship with corporate interests. Can you describe some of those? It doesn't have to be this way.
No, it doesn't. And I do spend a lot of time in Germany in particular, some other the European member states, and you can see that there both there are better laws for labor unions, making it easier to organize a labor union, protecting workers who organize a union from harassment. And then they also have other types of laws, like, for example, you know, Germany has Fortune 500 companies like we have here in the United States. But by law, workers get to elect 50% of the members of the board of directors of those Fortune 500 companies. It would be as if the workers of Walmart got to elect 50% of the members of the board of directors of Walmart. And in the American context, it's almost unimaginable. And yet that kind of thing is very common throughout Europe. And it really gives workers more leverage, it creates what they call their culture of consultation, where employers, you know, they just can't walk in and lay people off or change your working conditions. They really do have to consult with workers and convince them, look, this is going to be good for our business, and that means it's going to be good for you because you're going to work in this business, and we want to keep you as an employee. So, you know, there's many, many differences like that that really do can be done here. You know, if they can do it there, we certainly can do it here, but it's going to take people both being aware that you know, that this is possible. I mean, I ask a lot of Americans, have you ever heard of this? It's called co-determination. How many Americans ever heard of this? And, you know, when I give a lecture or something, maybe two hands will go up. Most people haven't even heard that this is what they do in these places. It's possible that we could do it here. Nonprofits could do it. Universities can do it. And we could start small that way and then build upon it to make it work better there. And in addition, if you're a part-time worker, and even many independent contractors, you are still eligible for benefits, at least to some degree. Whereas here, even, you know, part-time workers, you know, a business will say, oh, if you get over 30 hours a week, we give you benefits. And then they just make sure that you never get over 30 hours a week. They keep you at 29.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that kind of thing doesn't help you if you're a European employer, because you still have to pay benefits for that worker. And I should add that, you know, Europe is very successful economically. It has its big businesses. It has more Fortune 500 companies than the United States and Russia combined. And it has more small businesses than we have here in the United States as well. So it's not like we're talking about rules that are crippling the economy of Europe at all. They have a vibrant economy there, and workers have it better than they have here. So we can do that here if they can do it there.
Well, absolutely. And one thing we can all agree on, that it works much better when labor and capital work together. Stephen, we've about come to the end of our rope here, man. I certainly have enjoyed sharing your insights with our listening audience, and certainly I think if anything can come from this knowledge is that we have to start working continuously, man, to improve our conditions. And we can't wait until it happens to us before we are struggling to improve. So the injury to one is still an injury to all.
Some of these things that we can do at the local and state level, we don't have to wait for the federal level to get its act together, which, as we can see, is kind of a banana republic at this point.
Oh, yeah.
So I really encourage people to think about how you can make some of these changes at the local and state level and get them in place, and then, you know, grow them and scale them from your local city government to the state from there. I mean, here in San Francisco, where I live, we're trying to put in place what's called a portable safety net, especially for those independent contractors and freelance workers. Every business that hires that kind of worker would have to contribute a certain amount of money into an individual security account, just like a social security account for that worker that would be used to pay for that worker's safety net.
Yep.
And the amount that business pays would be
Steve, we're going to have to cut it there, Steve.
Works for that business. So there are things we can do right at the local level and not wait for the, you know, the Trump ridiculousness to go away.
Okay. Well, thank you, Steve, for being on the Heartland Labor Forum tonight, and we certainly appreciate your input, man. Good night to you.
Yo te quiero libre, libre y con amor, libre de la sombra, pero no del sol. Yo te quiero libre, como te viví, libre de otras penas y libre de mí.
And that's Silvio Rodriguez, famous Cuban folk singer, with a song called I Want You Free. And I'll just give you a couple of the lyrics. I want you free, free and with love, free from the shadows, but not from the sun. I want you free like how I lived you, free from other worries and free from me. Totally appropriate to talk about Cuban women. Hi, this is Judy Ansel. In December, a group of women labor lawyers and labor educators went to Cuba to learn about labor rights and specifically the position of women workers in the Cuban economy. We met with the leaders of the Cuban Women's Federation, labor law professors at the University of Havana, National Center for Sexual Education, and with labor lawyers. It was a fascinating trip because it's so different from labor rights in the U.S. and because Cuba is making pretty radical changes in its constitution, which will affect gender issues as well as the growing small business component of the economy in an attempt to mitigate the problems it has due to the continuing U.S. blockade as well as bureaucratic state planning. Tonight, we're going to focus on what we learned about women workers and labor law with two women who were on the delegation. Joan Hill, who organized the trip, is a labor educator for the United Steelworkers in Pittsburgh, and Erica Wills, who is a labor studies professor at the Los Angeles Trade and Technical College Labor Center. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Judy.
Let's start with general stuff. I was shocked to find out that 98% of Cuban workers are members of unions. I think that's probably the highest rate in the world. It's certainly even better than Sweden, I think. Is that because it's compulsory, or do they actually voluntarily join?
Let me respond to that, Judy. This is Joan. And my experience, and I've been traveling to Cuba since 2001 on delegations, 2002 on delegations related to labor studies. It is not compulsory. In fact, they actually collect dues voluntarily from workers who have to go to their union official and pay their weekly dues based upon a percentage of their salary or wages, and I don't know exactly what that rate is. It is consistent, though, with the triumph of the revolution. It is consistent with their concepts of socialism and the importance of what trade unions do for workers in Cuba. It's not just about representing them in the workplace, although that is a primary role, as in the United States, but they also take active roles as the trade union Congress, meeting with elected officials and give opinion and direction on policy matters related to legislation. They are advocates in the workplace when it comes to setting goals of production, which often are established through the state-run enterprises as well as the private sector. The other thing is that they offer education programs, and most workers have been through education that teaches them about their specific rights under the law, as well as how they can be better trade unionists, how they can be better workers, and how they can contribute to society beyond the four corners of their either collective agreement or their workplace.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You sent us an article before we went on this trip, which said that Cuban workers had the right to a written contract. They have Social Security. They have an eight-hour workday. They have 1 day a week for rest. They have 7 days of vacation, and I assume that's paid. And they get 1 year of paid parental leave if they have a kid. We'll get back to the parental leave. But anyway, we don't have a lot of those rights in the U.S.
Right, and I think we often try to turn the light or look in the mirror and think that we have great legislation that protects workers when it comes to their legal rights in the workplace. And one thing I've learned early on through this and from the lawyers that represent workers and the trade union Congress is to see that through activism, through legislation, through power within the legislative body, and having significant numbers of workers represented, like you said, nearly 100% of the workers belong to a trade union, that power is in their numbers, and they can push forward policy and legislation that benefits the workers and provides them not only with protections in the workplace, but benefits within their social structure when it comes to public education, the right to education, the right to certain food benefits, and all of that are established by law.
Yeah, and of course, let me just add that they also have free public education through college as well as free medical care. Erica, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, Joan, when you were talking about the power and numbers, one thing that I found really interesting when we met with the Workers Central Union of Cuba was they talked about the 15 trade unions that made up the Central Union. And those were based in different sectors like the sugarcane workers, food workers, tobacco workers, et cetera. And when we think in the U.S., we think about a union being in a specific workplace and just the workers in that workplace being part of that local. But what we heard about in Cuba was that people who were in the private employment sector or people who were retired workers could also join a union in the sector that they worked in or a sector that they were retired from, which I think really probably helps promote those high numbers and involvement with the labor union because it's more inclusive than just the people in that specific workplace.
And that does give them the power with their rights as pensioners. You know, the concept of education within Cuba, they talk about three stages. The stage is when you are actually enrolled in school, primary school and secondary school. The stage of your life when you are working and contributing to society as a worker. And the third stage as a pensioner. And the need that your activism, your education, your contribution to society continues even through that third stage.
Well, I want to switch topics a little bit and focus in on the women. One of the things that blew me away was the role that the Women's Federation played. We spent several hours at the Women's Federation. It's hard for Americans, I think, to imagine that there would be an organization in the country that was connected to the government but not necessarily taking orders from the government, which was an advocate for women's equality, which pushed new laws that would help women become more equal, and which stood up for women in a whole variety of situations in society. It's hard for us to imagine that because we don't have anything like it. Erica, can you talk some about the Women's Federation?
Right, absolutely. So I think the first important thing to know about the Federation of Cuban Women is that it was actually laid out in the Cuban Constitution after the revolution. So the Federation of Cuban Women has the power to initiate laws and norms through Parliament, basically the power to legislate and promote laws that favor women's issues. And one of the really interesting things is when working through Parliament, right now the Parliament in Cuba, the majority of the members are female. So that's something that is really striking, and these are issues that they have a real personal stake in. The Federation of Cuban Women, they function nationally by promoting laws that benefit women, but they really see their strength at the grassroots level, and they have about 81,000 community-level organizations. And this allows them to focus on the needs of specific communities, if it's the educational needs or the social support networks, that those specific women need in those places. And so they work really bottom-down through top-down through legislation and bottom-up through the needs of the members.
And one of the projects that they work on is countering violence against women, which is illegal, of course, in Cuba. I guess it's illegal here, too, but nobody does a whole lot about it. I mean, it's left to the private sector here, various nonprofit organizations. But in Cuba, the government seems to have a policy of organizing and educating women and men to counter which has been a serious social problem in Cuban society. That's really interesting to me. Joan, did you want to add anything more about the Women's Federation?
I was just thinking of, you know, this was understanding that this organization was the child of Wilma Espin, I believe it's
Wilma Espin.
Thank you. Who was a compañera of Fidel Castro. And she and others during the time of the revolution, they developed brigades of women who were actually fighting, you know, in the armed services, so to speak, of Cuba. And this carried forward to address some of the issues that women now are focusing on. I thought the focus on child care and how to bring the rights of children into this mix of the Federation of Women and how to develop professionals to provide child care in both education and health, how to transition children from child care, whether it's in a home or a daycare center, into being prepared for school. And I think they see so much the importance of education, and it's from, you know, the very, very early ages of the children of Cuba.
Okay. You know, one of the things they said is that the obstacles to women's equality are no longer legal. They're really ideological. And they're doing many things to try to change the ideology. I guess they're talking about macho or machismo. in Cuban society. And that interested me a lot. Were there other ways that impressed you guys that in ways that they're trying to overcome the ideological dominance of men?
Yeah, so I think that, first of all, out of everything that we heard as part of that delegation, that was one of the most striking things to me, was that they really recognized there was a difference between having a right on paper, a legal right, and having the opportunity in reality. And that they saw that what they were facing wasn't just making legal changes, but changing people's attitudes about gender, about what are stereotypically male and stereotypically female. And I think that there were several ways that they're trying to do that in practice. And one of them is the programs that the Federation of Cuban Women and also the Center for Sexual Education have that go into the communities and try to combat that machismo, try to talk about the ways in which the genders are equal and promote having sometimes females participate in sports. That was an example that they gave, in sports that are traditionally male sports. And that while they have that right on paper, getting past the attitudes and those gender stereotypes is the difficulty that they're facing and really the hurdle that they're trying to address right now.
Okay. So let's talk about the traditional gender division of labor. Has that changed very much in Cuba, or do you still have, you know, male jobs and female jobs?
This is Joan, and I think there is still some traditional women's work, and I don't know how that is really being changed as much other than through, again, younger workers. And I think that 1 year we visited a trade school where they had a lot of young workers who did not want to go to the university but wanted to learn a trade. And most of the students in the trade school were men. And we asked about, are women interested in this? And I think there is still some direction from the parents, from society, that women don't see themselves in those types of occupations. And I think the commentary from the Federation of Women was not only to show women that they could develop themselves into programs such as these, that they had that opportunity, but also to be given, to see themselves as a possibility of being in those trades. And I don't doubt that the opportunity is available, but I think women have still not fully grasped the possibility that this is something for them.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in a lot of the trades that we would normally see of building trades and the opportunity, and more or less the women taking seeing themselves within that possibility in that trade. But with more workers now transitioned into the private sector, I think that has opened a lot of doors for women to take what would have normally be seen as non-traditional work, whether it's in the arts, whether it's in managing businesses, whether it's in the tourist sector, whether it's in the food sector. All of that is, I think, the private sector has opened that door much more for women, and we've only been experiencing that for 6 to 7 years now. So I think it's still in its early stages.
I was just going to say that one of the statistics that the Federation of Cuban Women gave was that 70% of women workers are in the education and the healthcare sectors. And those are sectors that are traditionally associated with female workers. And so we can still see the gender divide there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the only other thing I would add kind of as a side note is that they recognized that while there's equal pay for equal work, while that's guaranteed for women workers, one of the challenges that these women workers still face is the unpaid gendered work they do in the home and the way that child care and housework and all those things are unpaid labor that women do, and oftentimes labor that they have to step outside of the employment, the paid employment sector, to do that kind of work, which can negatively affect their ability to get promotions or move up on the pay scale, and can create a kind of divide between what men and women are getting paid or the type of jobs they're doing, even though legally it's equal work for equal pay and women should be able to go into any type of employment sector.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I just want to say that that kind of leads into the whole issue of maternity and paternity benefits, which are very generous in Cuba. Women get 3 months before they give birth off of work with pay, and then they get 3 months after the birth of a baby, and that's for either the father or the mother. And actually, you have a right to take a full year off with pay. But that also, of course, impacts then the inequality of wages, because women tend to be the ones who take that time off, not men. And so that impacts their careers. But before we quit, I really want to get to the constitutional changes, and particularly the changes around gender issues. Either of you want to talk about that?
Well, I know we learned from the representative from the Center for Sex Education that talked about constitutional changes that would impact LGBTQ rights. Don't think he actually used the letter Q on it. It was just LGBT. And particularly talking about the rights of a family within that, whether it's transgendered, the rights to modify the definition of marriage, to embrace diversity within the family. And I think that's been a very positive change, although I think it's been in writing that these rights of LGBT were protected with the combination of the education programs that the center has done, as well as making it a constitutional protection, I think really recognizes society's interest in protecting the family and protecting individuals and their sexual orientation and gender identity.
And this is really quite a change for Cuba, because for years people who were gay were not treated equally. And so it's pretty revolutionary what's happening, although they also told us that the issue of gay marriage is still very, very controversial there. We're out of time. I told you this would go very fast. And we've been talking to Erica Wills and Joan Hill about labor and women in Cuba. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
No me vayas a engañar. Di la verdad. A lo mejor yo te gusto y quizás es bien para los dos. No me vayas a decir que no te has dado cuenta. No digas lo que no sientas por mí, no siendo la verdad. Soy tu refugio de amor. A lo mejor yo te gusto y quizás es bien para los dos. Thank you.
was Omara Portuando, one of the original members of the Buena Vista Social Club, who is in her 90s and one of the few still left alive. Now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. On Saturday, January 25th, day after tomorrow, from 5 to 7:30 p.m., there's going to be a film screening of the film Reversing Roe, that's Roe versus Wade, and a discussion. And that's at the Matt Ross Community Center at 8101 Marty Street in Overland Park. And the discussion is going to be with Dr. Colleen McNicholas, who's a physician featured in the film. Sunday is the Unitarian Forum, and it's on Drawdown, a comprehensive plan to reverse global warming. That's at 10 a.m. Sunday, January 26th at All Souls Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. Mayoral Candidate Forum, Monday, January 28th, from 5:15 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Californos, hosted by the Heartland Alliance for Progress. Rescheduled because of the Martin Luther King holiday, the monthly Workers' Rights Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft. That is Monday, January 28th, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro at 7th in Minnesota in Kansas City, Kansas. KC Race and Equity Initiative, Systems, Institutions, and Communities, Wednesday, January 30th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the GEM Theater, 1615 East 18th Street, hosted by Mayor Sly James. And finally, 2019 Missouri Legislative Session Preview, February 1st, 8 a.m. at Grace and Holy Trinity Cathedral, 415 West 13th Street, and that's sponsored by Empower Missouri. That's it for tonight's show. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn, who is also going to be hosting the 8 o'clock local showcase with blues music. So stay tuned for the Thursday night special and then listen in on Keith's music extravaganza. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, our show is called New Threats and Promises from Missouri and Kansas Legislatures. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The comments.